question, and it just so happens that I started a nonprofit. I co-founded a nonprofit called the Washington Immigrant Defense Network, and I have 4 co-founders, including me. And we are trying to harness the energy and
Hi, welcome to the Fieldwork Podcast, a show where continuing legal education is delivered through conversations about law and business. This episode, our host, Kyle Holton, will be interviewing Tamina Watson on the various aspects of immigration law. Tamina is an immigration lawyer at Watson Immigration Law in Seattle, Washington. So from the attic in Tangletown, this is the Fieldwork.
Today we're talking with Tamina Watson of Watson Immigration Law. We're going to talk about business visas and how people can get into the United States via their business endeavors. Tamina, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
I'd like to start just by getting into your background a little bit. I'd like to know how you got into immigration law.
It's a funny story because immigration was the last thing I wanted to do. But I moved to the United States from the UK when I got married to my husband, who's American. And then I had to go through the immigration process myself. And I grew up in a household where there was a lot of law. My father was an immigration lawyer in the UK. And I always wanted to be a lawyer, but I wanted to do something different than my dad. And I moved to the US and I take the New York bar exams, even though I live in Washington, because it was easier as a UK lawyer to take the New York bar exams. And I thought to myself that maybe I'd get a job at a law firm with an asterisk on my name, above my name, saying, you know, admitted in New York. But it was proving rather difficult. And eventually immigration landed on my lap a couple of times. And I thought, no, thank you, not immigration. And in my mind, it was only just asylum. I didn't think it could be more than that. And then the third time round, when it came and landed on my lap, I thought, well, you know, maybe I should just do this for 5 years and then wave into Washington and do what litigation. I wanted to do litigation. So I went into it, you know, I succumbed to the fact that this immigration has landed on my lap the third time. And the very first day I went into the office and I did immigration, I thought, why was I fighting this? It is everything and then more than what I expected immigration to be. And my background, my language, my experiences, all of the things together made me a good fit for it. And it's a fast-paced, really exciting and intellectually challenging area of law. So altogether, it just became my vocation and I just didn't know it.
That's really cool. And so you grew up in London, or is that right? But you also lived in another country
as well, right? I did. My parents are from Bangladesh, so my dad moved to the UK in the 60s for his education and got married to my mum, and she moved to the UK in the 70s. And then I was born, and I guess that shows how old I am. and then in the 80s, my dad was sort of really missing his home country. So he took us to Bangladesh when I was 8, and then we came back to London when I was 18. And so my formative years were in Bangladesh, so I learned the language, the culture, the family, and, you know, lots of Bollywood music and movies, so I can speak broken Hindi. And so when my clients say to me, can you speak Hindi? I say very little, and then they hear me speaking and they'll say, it's okay to me, it's okay to me, you don't have to speak Hindi with me. You know, but it's a very interesting way of sort of, and then I became a barrister in England, which is a trial attorney. And interestingly enough, you know, nobody knew what a barrister was in the US until George Clooney married one. I thought, he's done me such a good favor because now I can actually say I'm a barrister and people know what it is. I was practicing in the UK for about 18 months as a qualified barrister. And then I moved here.
You find that the international travel and living in multiple places and then immigrating to the US is helpful in advising your clients?
You know, honest to God, it is the thing that helps with understanding their backgrounds. Mm-hmm. And whether you live in South America or, you know, other parts of Europe or South Asia, you know, the cultural differences, some of them are similar and some of them are not. But when you, because I've lived in Europe and South Asia, it sort of really has a, gives me a good standing with my clients. And then when I can say, well, I also applied for my, you know, work permit and it didn't apply, you know, I arrived for 6 months and I was stuck. You know, the personal experience is really
relate on that level.
And then I've also had issues at the border. Mm. You know, this was in the, you know, Bush era as well as the Obama era, that the CBP was not very nice to me. And a lot of, and to my husband, who is, you know, white American, who's never had problems at the border until he marries a brown girl.
Yeah.
You know, it's, so it's an interesting experience of just going through that and then relating to the experiences that my clients are going through.
Yeah. So how did you get to the point where you started your own firm?
Not by choice. I initially, when I was looking for a job, I was struggling to find a job, and it was only 2 months of struggling, so I shouldn't really, nobody should have a violin for me.
Yeah.
But when I, my own immigration lawyer who got my green card, she needed some help, and I happened to be looking for a job, and that was the, how I landed my foot in the immigration world. But she's the person I learned how not to practice law from. And my husband, who is just amazing, had been sort of like, you know, coaching me and saying, you know, you should just do your own thing.
Yeah.
And at the time, there weren't a lot of South Asian immigration lawyers in Seattle. I happened to be maybe the third or fourth or fifth one that was, you know, coming into prominence. And he kept saying, just do your own thing. And I was scared. And then the partnership was coming to an end. And I thought, well, let me just try this.
Yeah.
And my husband was like, just if you fail, you fail. It's okay. And so he gave me the encouragement and I started my firm. And that was January 2009, actually. And it's coming up to 10 years next January.
Yeah.
So I'm starting my 10th anniversary party planning. So you're all invited.
Sweet. What are we doing?
I don't know yet. You know, don't know yet. It might be big. And so that's how it started. And my phone did not stop ringing from the very first day.
Wow, that's awesome.
And I've not looked back.
How did people know to contact you?
Well, I had my previous firm for about 2 years.
Okay.
And so I had established myself. And luckily, I kept the phone number I had
yeah,
the last 2 years.
Yeah, that helps.
But I was also writing in the community a lot, doing a lot of volunteer work. I really immersed myself in society. My husband is a patent lawyer and he works all the hours, which I didn't realize before we got married. And once you got married and you sort of live your married life, you know, it's daily life happens. And
yeah.
I found that I didn't have a lot of friends and my husband's at work. So anybody who'd say, come and join this bar association,
yeah.
I'd say, yes, okay,
sure.
And very quickly, there was a bar association meeting every week, you know. So that's how I really found friends and community. And that's how people were finding me.
Okay, cool. Well, let's switch gears a little bit and talk about the visas that might be a good fit for someone who's got a business they're looking to start in the United States. So can you just, like, at a high level go over what those options might be?
Yeah, you know, it's that there aren't a lot of great options for every single person looking for a visa, but some of the common ones are something called an E2 visa. That's when you invest in the United States for a business that you own or partially own. There's the L1 visa, which is a multinational transfer visa. If you're a manager, executive, or even if you have special knowledge of your business, you can transfer to the US. There is a visa called an H1B visa. It can be for self-employed business owners. There's some strategies involved and it's not the easiest, but it's often the only option. Those are the main visas, I would say. There are two other visas. There's the O visa, which is for dubbed the genius visa. And sometimes it can be used. It's not easy either. And then there's something called the EB-5 visa. That's when somebody invests at least $500,000 in their business. But the modern day startup founder is somebody that often doesn't necessarily fit within these criteria.
Yeah.
So often you are really, you know, bashing a square peg in a round hole. And, you know, you have helped with so many of our cases making that peg really fit. but there isn't a startup visa.
Yeah.
And if anybody is interested in learning about this, one of my pet subject matters has been the startup visa.
You've written about it, right?
I've written about it. I've written the book about it, and it's available on Amazon. It's called The Startup Visa Key to Job Growth and Prosperity in America. And it's the foreword is written by somebody called Vivek Wadhwa. He's an academic, Indian background, and he writes a lot about entrepreneurship and immigrant contributions to the U.S. And my editor, her name is Lornette Turnbull, who used to be a journalist with the Seattle Times and now writes for the Washington Post. So I've got some good credentials behind my book.
Yeah, that's cool.
And I highly recommend people read it.
Are you working on writing anything right now?
I've written a lot, actually, but not necessarily a book. Mm-hmm. These days I'm trying to make sure people get information, articles about the latest changes in law that's going to affect my clients and just people out there.
So much is happening so quickly now. So you have a blog that you write on regularly?
Yes, I do. My blog is called the Watson Immigration Law Blog, which is on our website.
Cool.
But we often, and I would encourage people to sign up to the blog, because often our articles are published in the KCBA Bar Bulletin or Huffington Post or other news outlets, so that I can reach a broader audience.
Very cool. Can we talk about what the visa application process is like at a high level? So what are the agencies that you're working with, and like how long does the process take, and what, like, just at a really high level, how does that work?
Sure, that's a really good question. Except for the E2 visa, and sometimes it can apply to the E2 visa too in certain circumstances, most visas would be applied for in the United States with the agency called USCIS, United States Citizenship and Immigration Services, which is under the umbrella of the Department of Homeland Security. And the application is filed with them, and there are two ways to file it. You can file it regular processing, giving them the general fees, or you could give them an extra $1,225 for expedited fees, and they will look at your case quicker. Once they approve it, and if you're not in the United States, you would then go to the embassy, which is the umbrella organization is the agency of the Department of State. So all the consulates are operated by the Department of State. So the consulates will then go over you as an individual, verify information in the application, keep your passport, put a visa stamp on it, depending what kind of visa you're getting, and then you come to the U.S.
Okay, so if you have an L1 visa, so you would first apply with USCIS, they approve it, then you go to your office in Rome or whatever.
That's right.
And then they'll give you the visa and then you get in.
That's correct.
Got it. Hey everyone, this is Kyle.
And Gavin.
From the Fieldwork Podcast. Keep listening and we'll share the code you'll need to get your CLE credits.
And if you like what you hear, please leave us a review on your preferred podcast platform.
Cool. Can we talk a little bit about so you mentioned the H-1B is like the only option sometimes. So how does that one work?
So the H-1B visa is the most popular skilled professional visa. And when it was first created, and even still, it's you have to have an employer who is applying for the visa for you. When we had President Obama in office, who was very pro-entrepreneurship, he had created policies that thankfully still exist. And he allowed H-1Bs to be self-employed. And in that situation, you still have to show that your business is your employer. And often the board of directors are your quote unquote employers, or your other partners who have supervisory control over you. And that's how you show the employer-employee relationship. But H-1Bs have come under extreme scrutiny in the Trump administration. In April 2017, the administration and the president signed an executive order called the Buy American, Hire American executive order. And that, unfortunately, is having very negative effects on all type of business visas, but particularly on H-1B visas. Last year, they were questioning the level of wages that people are getting, and the Buy American, Hire American executive order had this one particular sentence saying only the highest paid and the brightest people will get H-1Bs. And taking that phrase, they really applied it in unprecedented ways. So last year we saw wages being questioned for the very first time ever. And the usual scrutiny has always been whether this job needs a degree. And the term for that is specialty occupation. Is this a specialty occupation, meaning that the job needs a degree and you have that degree? And there has to be a nexus between those degrees. So you can't be a lawyer applying for a doctor's job. They'll deny it. And this becomes a difficult challenge when they are computer-related jobs, because often there is a lot of overlap. And a lot of the clients I serve are in the, you know, IT industry. I deal with all sorts of industries, but the IT industry has been particularly hit, where computer systems analysts and data analysts and, you know, business intelligence analysts and financial analysts, all of these jobs have sort of been scrutinized to the extent that they are denying them. And cases that were being approved, you know, in June started to get denied in October. And with the same, very same evidence. But what we have seen with this administration is that they don't read the paperwork that we're giving them. They are completely arbitrary, and they are arbitrary in their reasoning. So, for example, you can always have an academic give you testimony saying this particular job, in my opinion, because I teach it, requires a degree in this particular subject matter. And the government has come back. This is the first time we've seen these arguments saying, well, this academic hasn't gone to your work site. How does he know about this? And an academic doesn't need to go to the work site. So we are seeing arguments that are thrown at us completely sort of unfounded. And these denials, even if you appeal them, are being denied as well. So we're in very uncharted territory at the moment with H-1Bs, and that was 2017. 2018, you know, the H-1Bs were filed in April, and we're just starting to see the movement on those. So it'll be very interesting to see what happens. But clients are anxious.
Yeah.
Students are anxious. I am anxious.
Yeah. It's tough to advise your clients when you don't know what the government's going to do.
Yeah. I mean, one of the other examples is, you know, you have to have a nexus in the subject matter for H-1Bs. And let's say a financial analyst, take that example. And there is a Department of Labor dictionary, if you like. It's a occupational handbook. It's a dictionary of all the jobs that exist in the United States. And the financial analyst is listed there. And it says you can have a degree in statistics, math, economics, finance, and one other. But they're all mathematics related. And you're showing that this is a group almost of the same subject matter based on mathematics. But the government came back and said, well, it's got five separate subject matters, and therefore it can't be a specialty occupation. And this could be very problematic for lawyers too. I mean, H-1Bs are applied for by doctors, lawyers, architects, and none of these professions were spared last year. Doctors, architects, they were all getting the same blanket template RFE. And so we are dealing with an administration that's really looking for problems.
Yeah.
And every week, particularly on a Friday, you sort of brace yourself thinking what news is coming out today.
Yeah. What's an RFE?
An RFE is a request for further evidence.
Okay. Gotcha. And so with H-1Bs, there's a lottery. Is that right? You apply in April,
right,
then you'll find out in July or something like that.
That's right. So the H-1B visa starts the fiscal year, October 1. And for any work visa, you can apply 6 months in advance. So April 1 is when the window opens. But they have 65,000 visas for people with a bachelor's degree. And anybody with a master's degree from a different country would also fall in the bachelor's degree category. And people who have master's degrees from a U.S. school will have the privilege of being in a separate category of 20,000. So altogether, there are 85,000 visas.
So then if you win the lottery, you still have to apply and show proof that you fit within the visa. Is that
That's correct. So you've got like a two-pronged, you know, anxious zone. First, you're like worried, are you going to be picked?
Yeah.
And if you picked and you have a hurrah moment, then you're like, oh, am I going to be approved?
Got it. So let's switch and talk about the E2s. Can you tell me just like at a high level how the E2 visa works, what you have to show and what the process timeline is like?
The E2 visa is a a great visa if you come from one of the countries where they have a treaty with the United States. So it's called a treaty investor visa. There's also a treaty trader visa, E1s. They are used, but the E2 is used more. The treaty has to exist with that country and the US. So many of the prominent countries where citizens come from to the US are not on this treaty list, unfortunately. Countries like India and China, for example, are not on this list. But otherwise, it's a really good visa to have if you are going to actually invest in a business. The rule of thumb is you should invest $100,000, although the statute does not actually dictate how much money you should invest. It says substantial. And then it has to be proportionate to the business. So if you are buying a hotel, you might need millions. But if you're buying a grocery store, you might need 100,000. What we tell our clients, and most immigration lawyers will tell their clients, is $100,000 is a good rule of thumb. The government is going to look at where did the money come from. So they're looking at source of funds. Did you earn it? Did you inherit it? Did you sell your property? And you have to document all of that very, very carefully. The government recently, taking this Buy American, Hire American executive order, has updated their own policies. And we are starting to see the Department of State and these embassies highly scrutinize very good cases. And it's troubling because the E2 visa has typically been a favorite of the consulates because talented people are coming, investing their own money, creating jobs.
Yeah.
It's win-win for everybody. However, because this administration has this Buy American, Hire American executive order, they are really taking it, you know, literally. And we have seen problems in some of our cases, and I'm hearing a lot of stories from others. And the trending issue is we don't know what the problem will be because they're just making things up.
Yeah. So are some people who are from some countries are finding it more easy to get their visa approved than people from some other countries if it's an E2? Like some offices are looking at things with higher scrutiny?
You know, it's hard to tell because it's a trending issue.
Yeah.
There are one or two embassies that have become notorious for causing, you know, difficulties. But on the whole, I'm still optimistic about E2 visas because, you know, my clients who are on E2 visas are really, really talented people. They're such fun people to work with as well because they're intelligent, they know what to do, and they actually respond to the things I need. And they really have a vision for what they actually are trying to do in the US. I'm very optimistic about the E2 still, despite the troubles that this administration is trying to cause. And if anybody qualifies for the E2 visa, I always try to recommend that they try to do that first. Obviously, every case is different.
Yeah.
Some people have different needs and requirements, and every visa has its own sort of quirky rules about what you do next and, you know, how long you can stay here.
Yeah.
So even with these considerations, the E2 often will give you the autonomy that you need. And so it's one of my favorite visas, if you like.
How long can you stay with an E2?
The visa that you initially get, depending on which country you come from, can be for 5 years.
Okay.
But when you actually travel into the US, you're given 2 years at a time. So you have to travel outside and come back to get another 2 years. But there are some people in the US who've been on an E2 for 30 plus years. It's a very good visa for having your business. Typically, it's a small business, a small to medium-sized business. And there are groups of people who want to see a green card option from the E2. There is none. There are other options that you could think about, but there's no direct option.
Yeah.
And one of the things about being on an E2 for very long is if you have children and they age out, which is if you're over 21, you're not a dependent anymore. Those children then have to find their own path for visa options. And so the people who've been here on E2s for 30 plus years have their own sort of issues to deal with.
Got it. So what's one of the ways that someone who has an E2 could get a green card or other permanent?
Good question. It depends on the individual and the case itself and the business they have. Often an E2 could be a wonderful way to piggyback into the EB5 program, because any investment that you've made into the E2 could actually be used for the EB5 program as well. And often these E2 visas or vehicles, these are businesses, are creating jobs all the time, particularly restaurants, let's say. You know, they always have servers and chefs and so forth. And the EB5 visa requires that you create 10 jobs. And for a restaurant, for example, 10 jobs is not a big deal. So the EB5 is often a good vehicle for some people. The other option sometimes is something called a national interest waiver. It's a very established visa category, but the law wasn't stipulated by statute. It was defined by case law precedent. And it was a very difficult one to prove as a business owner. And when President Obama, that I mentioned earlier, had allowed self-employed folks to get H-1Bs, at that time the policy was, you know, set out that those people would get a national interest waiver, which is, you are so important to the country, we're waiving the requirement that you have to prove there is no other American to do this job. And so the national interest waiver, and that's a discussion for another time, but is often a good option. The rules have been changed a little since just as President Obama left, and it's made it more favorable to show that you are beneficial to the United States. And so, you know, it's a relatively new set of rules, but that's something to look at. So EB-5, maybe national interest waiver. For some who are just extraordinary, you know, they've raised a lot of money and they have a lot of jobs around the country, and they've been written as, you know, the front page of Fast Company or something like that, they could possibly consider something called an EB1. So really, the options depend on the individual and their business.
Yeah, okay, cool.
Hey everyone, this is Gavin.
And Kyle.
From the Fieldwork Podcast. This is your reminder that you can get CLE credits just for listening.
After this episode, go to yourfieldguide.com to receive your CLE credits.
And to convince those in charge that you actually listened, you'll need this top secret code.
Option.
What was that?
Option.
Can you say it one more time?
Option.
Got it. Option. And now, back to the show.
Let's switch it up and talk about the L1 visa now. So how does the L1 work? I think you mentioned that it was the option for multinational companies.
Mm-hmm. So it's a very good visa if you have been running your own business in a different country for years. And what I see from my clients, the world of technology has progressed so much that you don't necessarily need to be in the U.S. to have a consumer base here. You know, I often deal with clients who have, you know, $1 million, you know, revenue stream coming from the U.S. while they're in, let's call it Timbuktu, you know. And so those people then often need to come to the U.S. to actually have face time with their clients and see the opportunity to expand. And so the multinational transfer is for a business that already exists outside the country to come to the U.S. and open a branch here. And they initially have to show the qualifying relationship between the two entities. And you have been amazing in often figuring out what the best entity is. And if your listeners don't know, I mean, Kyle really is a genius in figuring out really complicated corporate structures.
Thanks.
And you've helped us with a lot of sticky situations. I'm so grateful.
It's fun.
It's been really fun, you know, working with you. And so the corporate entity is very important as a foundation level, because if that doesn't work, which is where you have helped us, the rest of it falls apart. And so often the clients will have to figure out what kind of entity are they having. And once that's figured out, then you have to show, is the business abroad active and operating? Is the business in the U.S. active and operating? Is the job abroad one that qualifies? Is it a manager, executive, or one of specialized knowledge? And the job in the U.S., are they the same? And then you also have to show whether the individual has worked for the foreign company for at least 1 year out of the last 3 years. In recent history, with the Baja executive order, Buy American, Hire American executive order, unfortunately that's causing problems in this arena too. And in fact, I'm going to be attending a CLE next week, and the line was, does anybody get an approval on L1s without a request for evidence anymore? Mm. and you used to be able to, but in recent history it's been more and more difficult. But there are two ways of looking at this. USCIS will look at this application as a new office, meaning have you just established, and they have a higher scrutiny for that. Where did the funds come from to pay for the opening of this office, and do you actually have an office? But if you've been established for some time, these issues are still looked at, but it really helps in how long your visa will be. If it's a new office, you will only get 1 year because you've got to prove yourself that you are actually doing what you plan to do. But if you've been established, then you get a 3-year visa. And for a lot of people, that's very important.
Can you renew those visas? So at the end of the, if you only get one for a year, can you renew it for?
Yes, yes, you can. So the L1A, which is for managers and executives, you can have it for a total of 7 years. And those who come with specialized knowledge can only get it for 5.
Got it. And how do, if they have family members, is there a way that their family members can come into the country as
yeah,
well?
Yeah, great question. And this applies to all work visas. The dependents can come to the U.S. as a dependent. So the spouse and the children. Parents, unfortunately, are not dependents, even though a lot of people have parents who depend on them.
Yeah.
But from an immigration perspective, they're not.
Okay.
Some spouses can work. So an E2 spouse and an L2 spouse can actually work, apply for a work visa. But the other categories, like an H1B visa holder, their spouses can only work in certain situations, but this administration's taking that privilege away very soon. And that's a story for another time, too.
Got it. Okay. I'm getting the sense that practicing under this administration is significantly different than the previous administration. Can you talk a little bit about, you know, where you think it might go, and just you know, how it's been different and how it affects your job?
That's a really amazing question, because I could talk about that all day. When I started practicing and I had my own business and I started to make the startup visa my pet subject matter, it became my pet cause, because people were coming to me for that reason. And it made me go into the world of policy. I didn't really understand what policy really meant until I started to see that I could shape the law if I wanted to, and I really tried. And all of that led to sort of advocating for immigration reform. And at the time, you wanted to make the law better. You know, immigration reform would help many, many different issues. And so I became an advocate for that. And all of that led to having the privilege of being on Hillary Clinton's immigration working team, which was fabulous because she was going to introduce immigration reform in the first 100 days of her office. And then came the election, which we lost. And then the writing was on the wall about what this administration will do. Complete Muslim ban, which we now have 18 months later. Mass deportation, he's working on it. And many other things that he's promised. So in November, after crying for a week, I picked myself up and I asked the local Immigration Lawyers Association to give me a committee so that we can start preparing for what's coming down the pike. So they helped me create something called the Response Committee. And because of my very deep connections in the community, where I'm writing and on the radio show and, you know, my blog and my clients and the volunteer work, people coming to me from all different directions. And so the challenge has been to actually respond to the various fast and furious policy changes that he's making. And you know, 18 months ago, I would never have been able to predict this is how bad it was going to be. And so when I was an advocate advocating for immigration reform in the Obama era, I was wanting the immigration laws to be better. Now I'm advocating for, like, don't touch it.
Yeah.
Leave it as it is. But it's, you know, they're just really making it difficult for everybody. New rules are coming in for student visas starting August 9th. They have made so many changes, I don't even know where to begin. But every type of client that I have is affected in some way or another. And on top of all of the substantive changes that they're making them through executive orders and policy changes. What we really need is actually comprehensive immigration reform that is done by Congress. You know, there are two houses in Congress, the House of Representatives and the Senate, and we have elected them and they should be our voice, and we should have laws that are you know, entrenched in statute, not through whimsical, you know, anti-immigration, white supremacist, nationalist ideology that's being poured into policy. So every day is difficult because an E2, for example, that used to be so simple, well, not simple, but not as difficult.
Yeah.
Is now a challenge that I've never anticipated before. Somebody who's going to get citizenship is now having difficulty, you know, understanding what are the things that they're going to challenge, because the government has now created a new denaturalization department and they're beefing that up. You know, you might have heard, and your listeners might have heard, when the administration came into office, they were talking about chain migration. And the denaturalization program is really going to denaturalize in a chain migration way, too. And I'm going to have to make up a nice word for that. Demigration. I don't know. Yeah. I'll come up with something and blog about it. But really, just yesterday I heard about a family friend's friend who was denaturalized and deported. And anybody who had their immigration status through this person is now going to have to think about what are they going to do.
So that's the opposite of chain migration. So chain migration is someone comes into the country and then their dependents can come with them, their spouse or their kids. And then this is the reverse, basically. They lose their rights instead of their spouse and kids.
In essence, yes, but let's be clear, chain migration was not a thing before this administration came along. It's actually called family-based immigration, and it is entrenched in law, and it's always been there, where if you are coming to the U.S., you can bring your spouse, your children, and your parents. The siblings can come, but they have a very different category, very lengthy. You cannot bring your aunt, you cannot bring your grandma, but the chain migration term that this administration has instilled in the vocabulary of, you know, a Trumpian society conjures the image that everybody in your family is coming with you.
Yeah.
And that's simply not true. So the biggest challenge is the anxiety and the fear that he has caused within the community, because he promised a complete Muslim ban. And we saw the haphazard first travel ban.
Yeah.
And then we saw the second iteration. Then we saw the third iteration. And now the Supreme Court has actually validated it, saying we're looking at the four corners of this executive order. We're not looking outside it. But lo and behold, everything outside it is what brought these four corners to
yeah.
be. And if it's travel ban for these nine countries at the moment, most of them are majority Muslim countries, wants to say they're not going to add more countries to it. And the waivers, there are waivers, you know, available for people coming to this, based on these visas, but they're not approving any of these waivers. I have a client who has a fiance, Iranian, and now we're sort of struggling to figure out what are we going to do? Is this person ever going to get a waiver to come to the U.S.? So while he's trying to have a complete Muslim ban, the trouble is these are affecting Americans. Day in, day out, every type of American, whether it's American businesses, whether it's American individuals, you know, whether it's family, businesses, investors, you name it, the ripple effect is really affecting Americans. So
yeah.
the idea that he's, you know, protecting America is really not true.
Switching gears again, so this is something that I like to, towards the end of the podcast, just ask What's something that you wish you would have known beforehand, but you learned through experience? Or maybe another way of looking at it is, if someone's just starting their own immigration practice, what's something, like, what's a valuable little piece of wisdom you might share?
I would say just be open to anything and everything, because you absolutely need to make sure that you are flexible. And just learn.
Yeah.
You're always a student.
Do you have any resources that you found were particularly helpful for learning? Was there like a book, website, or you know, association or anything like that?
For immigration lawyers, there's the American Immigration Lawyers Association. It's a national organization which has, I think, maybe 15,000 immigration lawyers, and they have chapters in every state.
Oh, cool.
And I actually personally think that if you're an immigration lawyer and you are not a member of AILA, you're not a competent lawyer. Because the the organization has resources that are infinite, you know, whether it's books and guidance and memos and, you know, anything and everything about immigration, you will find that it's a one-stop shop. But it also has access to all these other brilliant minds who can mentor you, answer your questions. The way I see it is that any question that I have, somebody's had it before. Maybe not in the Trump administration, you know, because we're all learning.
Everything's novel.
Everything is novel, but you know, one thing leads to another, and there are there's camaraderie, and it's one of the most supportive groups actually compared to all the other bar associations,
yeah.
Because it's not adversarial in the same way. We're our enemy, so to speak, is the government, if you like. You know, we're all battling together to find a good result for our clients. So there's a lot of support.
All right, last question. What's your favorite not legal related favorite book or podcast or TV series that you might recommend to people to check out?
Yeah, I love this question because I've become an Audible fan in
the last
6 months.
I love Audible.
I love it. I discovered it because I started to commute by car.
Yeah.
And it took me a while to figure out what do I do with this waste of time.
Yeah.
And so I've discovered Audible and I love it. I've listened to a lot of biographies. My all-time favorite at this point is Eleanor Roosevelt's biography,
cool.
Because the human rights abuses we're seeing in America right this moment, you know, she was the one who helped the United Nations Declaration on Human Rights. And so to learn about her life has just been one of the things that I've embraced, and I'm trying to channel her in all the advocacy that I'm doing. In terms of podcasts, that's something new to me too. I mean, I've been hosting my own radio show for 2.5 years, and my paralegal Nicole has always said to me, you should do a podcast and put this up on a podcast and listen to podcasts, and I wasn't really getting it. And when I started to listen to podcasts, I was listening to politics and all sorts, and I just wanted to get away from it.
Yeah.
So my favorite podcast at the moment is Oprah Winfrey's Super Soul Conversations.
Oh, cool.
And
I don't know about that one.
It's really, really insightful and spiritual, and it helps sort of deal with the anxiety that I am facing with all my clients and society.
Yeah.
Like, how do you manage all of this? What do you do? And the power of love and the power of now. All of these things I'm actually implementing in my daily life. The other one is, you know, I'm a busy mom. Two kids, so the house doesn't get clean and the dishes don't get clean. And the children, it's like, do you feed them today or bathe them today?
Yeah.
You know, that sort of thing. But there's a podcast called I Don't Know How She Does It. And it's an Australian podcast where this woman invites all these other superwomen who have 5 children and 10 books and 3 businesses. I'm like, how do they do it?
Yeah.
You know? So I've been listening to that, and that's been fun.
Cool. That sounds fun. Well, thanks for joining us today. So to quickly recap, we went over business visas at a high level, walked through a couple of the different options. So there was the H-1B, which is a lottery. And then if you get picked in the lottery, you still have to prove that you are
you have a degree.
Yeah, you have a degree, and that you meet the qualifications. And then we looked at the E2 visa, which is if you're from a treaty country and you put a sufficient amount of money into your business, often 100 grand is the rule of thumb. And then there's the L1 visa for intercompany transfers for multinational companies. And then we also talked a little bit about the rapidly changing regulatory landscape. So that's a quick recap of our conversation today. Thanks, Tamina. It's been fun.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thanks.